And the driver reminded me to be careful crossing the street. She pulled back the lever that opened the door, letting fragrant air onto the bus. I was about to step off coatless, but then someone cried out, "Hey, Hema, you forgot this." I was startled that anyone on the bus knew my name. I had forgotten about the name tag. By the following year, I had outgrown the coat, and to my great relief, it was donated to charity. The other items your parents bequeathed to us, the toaster and the crockery and the Teflon pots and pans, were gradually replaced as well, until there was no longer any physical trace of you in the house. For years, our families had no contact. The friendship did not merit the same energy my parents devoted to their relatives, buying stacks of aerograms at the post office and sending them off faithfully every week, asking me to write the same three sentences to each set of grandparents at the bottom. My parents spoke of you rarely, and I imagine they assumed that our paths were unlikely to cross again. You'd moved to Bombay, a city far from Calcutta, which my parents and I never visited, and so we did not see you or hear from you until the first day of 1981, when your father called us very early in the morning to wish us a Happy New Year and say that your family was returning to Massachusetts, where he had a new job. He asked if, until he found a house, you could all stay with us. For days after, my parents talked of nothing else. They wondered what had gone wrong. Had your father's position at Larsen & Toubro, too good to turn down at the time, fallen through? Was your mother no longer able to abide the mess and heat of India? Had they decided that the schools weren't good enough for you back there? Back then, international calls were kept short. "Of course your family was welcome," my parents said, and marked the date of your arrival on the calendar in our kitchen. Whatever the reason you were coming, I gathered from my parents' talk that it was regarded as a wavering, a weakness. "They should have known it's impossible to go back," they said to their friends, condemning your parents for having failed at both ends. "We had stuck it out as immigrants while you had fled. Had we been the ones to go back to India, my parents seemed to suggest, we would have stuck it out there as well. Until your return, I thought of you as a boy of 8 or 9, frozen in time, the size of the clothes I'd inherited. But you are twice that now, 16, and my parents thought it best that you occupy my room, and that I sleep on a folding cot set up in their bedroom. Your parents would stay in the guest room down the hall. My parents often hosted friends who came from New Jersey or New Hampshire for the weekend, to eat elaborate dinners and talk late into the evening about Indian politics. But by Sunday afternoon, those guests were always gone. I was accustomed to having children sleep on the floor by my bed, in sleeping bags. Being an only child, I enjoyed this occasional company, but I had never been asked to relinquish my room entirely. I asked my mother why they weren't giving you the folding cot instead of me. "Where would we put it?" she asked. "We only have 3 bedrooms. "Downstairs," I suggested, "in the living room." "That wouldn't look right," my mother said. "Kaushik must be practically a man by now. He needs his privacy." "What about the basement?" I said, thinking of the small study my father had built there, lined with metal bookcases. "That's no way to treat guests, Hema, especially not these. Dr. Chowdhury and Parul D were such a blessing when we first had you. They drove us home from the hospital. They brought over food for weeks. Now it's our turn to be helpful." "What sort of doctor is he?" I asked. Though I had always been in good health, I had an irrational fear of doctors then, and the thought of one living in the house made me nervous, as if his mere presence might make one of us sick.
"He's not a medical doctor. It refers to his PhD. Baba has his PhD and no one calls him a doctor," I pointed out.
"When we met, Dr. Chowdhury was the only one. It was our way of paying respect."
I asked how long you would be staying with us. "A week? 2? My mother couldn't say. It all depended on how long it took your family to get settled and find a place. The prospect of having to give up my room infuriated me. My feelings were complicated by the fact that until rather recently, to my great shame, I'd regularly slept with my parents on the cot in their room, and not in the room where I kept my clothes and things. My mother considered the idea of a child sleeping alone a cruel American practice, and therefore did not encourage it, even when we had the space. She told me that she had slept in the same bed as her parents until the day she was married, and that this was perfectly normal. But I knew it was not normal. Not what my friends at school did, and that they would ridicule me if they knew. The summer before I started middle school, I insisted on sleeping alone. In the beginning, my mother kept checking on me during the night, as if I were still an infant who might suddenly stop breathing, asking if I was scared and reminding me that she was just on the other side of the wall. In fact, I was scared that first night, perfect silence in my room terrified me. But I refused to admit this, for what I feared more was failing at something I should have learned to do at the age of 3 or 4. In the end, it was easy. I fell asleep out of sheer anxiety that I would not, and in the morning I woke up alone, squinting in the eastern light my parents' room did not receive. The house was prepared for your arrival. New throw pillows were purchased for the living room sofa, bright orange against the brown tweed upholstery. The plants and the curios were rearranged, my school portrait framed and hung above the fireplace. The Christmas cards were taken down from the front door, where my mother and I had taped them one by one as they came in the mail. My parents, remembering your father's habit of dressing well, bought robes to wear in the mornings. My mother's made of velour, my father's style like a smoking jacket. One day I came home from school and found that the pink and white coverlet on my bed had been replaced by a tan blanket. There were new towels in the bathroom for you and your parents, plusher than the ones we used, and a prettier shade of blue. My closet had been weeded, bare hangers left on the rod. I was told to clear out a couple of drawers, and I removed enough things so that I would not have to enter the room while you were in it. I took my pajamas, some outfits to wear to school, and the sneakers I needed for gym. I took the library book I was reading, along with others stacked on my bedside table. I wanted you to see as few of my things as possible, so I cleared away my jewelry box full of cheap tangled chains and my bottles of Avon perfume. I removed the locked diary from my desk drawer, though I'd written only 2 entries since receiving it for Christmas. I removed the 7th grade yearbook in which my photograph appeared, the end papers filled with silly messages from my classmates. It was like deciding which of my possessions I wanted to take on a long trip to India, only this time I was going nowhere. Still, I put my things into a suitcase covered with peeling tags and stickers that had traveled various times back and forth across the world, and dragged it into my parents' room. I studied pictures of your parents. We had a few pasted into an album, taken the night of the farewell party. There was my father, his stiff jet black hair already a surprise to me by then. He was dressed in a sweater vest, his shirt cuffs rolled back, pointing urgently at something beyond the frame. Your father was in the suit and tie he always wore, his handsome, bespectacled face leaning towards someone in conversation, his greenish eyes unlike anyone else's. The middle part in your mother's hair accentuated the narrow length of her face. The end of her raw silk sari was wrapped around her shoulders like a shawl. My mother stood beside her, a head shorter and more disheveled, stray hairs hanging by her ears. They both appeared flushed, the color high in their cheeks, as if from drinking wine, even though all they ever drank in those days was tap water or tea. The bond between them clear. There is no evidence of you, the person I was most curious about. Who knows where you had lurked in that crowd? I imagine you sat at the desk in the corner of my parents' bedroom, reading a book you'd brought with you, waiting for the party to end. My father went one evening to the airport to greet you. It was a school night for me. The dining table had been set since the afternoon. This was my mother's way when she gave parties, though she never prepared such an elaborate meal in the middle of the week. An hour before you were expected, she turned on the oven. She had heated up a pan full of oil and begun to fry thick slices of eggplant to serve with the dal, filling the room with a haze of smoke, when my father called to say that though your plane had landed, one of your suitcases had not arrived. I was hungry by then, but it felt wrong to ask my mother to open the oven door and pull out all the dishes for my sake. My mother turned off the oil, and I sat with her on the sofa watching a movie on television, something about the Second World War, in which a group of tired men were walking across a dark field. Cinema of a certain period was one thing my mother loved wholeheartedly about the West. She herself never wore a skirt. She considered it indecent, but she could recall, scene by scene, Audrey Hepburn's outfits in any given movie. I fell asleep at her side, and the next thing I knew, I was sprawled on the sofa alone, the television turned off, voices filling another part of the house. I stood up, my face hot, my limbs cramped and heavy. You were all in the dining room, eating. Pans of food lined the table, and in addition to the water pitcher, there was a bottle of Johnny Walker that only your parents were drinking, planted between their plates. There was your mother, her slippery dark hair cut to her shoulders, wearing slacks and a tunic. A silk scarf knotted at her neck, looking only vaguely like the woman I'd seen in the pictures. With her bright lipstick and frosted eyelids, she looked less exhausted than my mother did. She had remained thin, her collarbones glamorously protruding, unburdened by the weight of middle age that now padded my mother's features. Your father looked more or less the same, still handsome, still wearing a jacket and a tie, a different style of glasses, his concession to the new decade. You were pale like your father, long bangs combed over to one side of your face, your eyes distracted yet missing nothing. I had not expected you to be handsome. I had not expected to find you appealing in the least.
My goodness, Emma, already a lady? You don't remember us, do you? Your mother said.
She spoke to me in English, in a pleasant, unhurried way, with a voice that sounded amused.
Come, poor thing, we've kept you waiting. Your mother told us you went hungry because of us.
I sat down, embarrassed that you had seen me asleep on the sofa. Though you had all just flown halfway across the world, it was I who felt weary despite my nap. My mother served me a plate of food, but her attention was on you and the fact that you were refusing seconds.
We had dinner before we landed, you replied,
a faint accent present in your English, but not the strong accent our parents shared. Your voice had deepened, no longer a child's.
It's remarkable the amount of food you get in first class, your mother said. Champagne, chocolates, even caviar. But I saved room. I remembered your cooking, Shibani, she added. First class, my mother exclaimed with an intake of breath. How did you end up there?
It was my 40th birthday gift, your mother explained. She looked over at your father, smiling.
Once in a lifetime, right?
Who knows, he said,
clearly proud of the extravagance.
It could become a terrible habit.
Our parents spoke of the old Cambridge crowd, mine telling yours about people's moves and accomplishments, the bachelors who had married, the children who had been born. They spoke about Reagan winning the election, all the ways that Carter had failed. Your parents spoke of Rome, where you had had a 2-day layover to tour the city. Your mother described the fountains and the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel you had stood 3 hours in line to see.
So many lovely churches, she said. Each is like a museum. It made me want to be a Catholic, only to be able to pray in them.
Do not die before seeing the Pantheon, your father said,
and my parents nodded, not knowing what the Pantheon was. I knew. I was, in fact, in the middle of learning about ancient Rome in my Latin class, writing a long report about its art and architecture, all of it based on encyclopedia entries and other books in the school library. Your parents spoke of Bombay and the home you had left behind, a flat on the 10th floor with a balcony overlooking palm trees and the Arabian Sea.
A pity you didn't visit us there, your mother said.
Later in the privacy of their bedroom, my mother pointed out to my father that we had never been invited. After dinner, I was told to show you the house and where you would sleep. Normally, I love to do this for guests, taking a proprietary pleasure in explaining that this was the broom closet, that the downstairs half-bath. But now I lingered over nothing, for I sensed your boredom. I was also nervous at being sent off with you, disturbed by the immediate schoolgirl attraction I felt. I was used to admiring boys by then, boys in my class who were and would remain unaware of my existence. But never someone as old as you, never someone belonging to the world of my parents. It was you who led me, climbing quickly up the stairs, opening doors, poking your head into rooms, unimpressed by it all.
This is my room, your room, I said, correcting myself.
After dreading it all this time, now I was secretly thrilled that you'd be sleeping here. You would absorb my presence, I thought. Without my having to do a thing, you would come to know me and like me. You walked across the room to the window, opened it, and leaned out into the darkness, letting cold air into the room.
Ever go out on the roof? You asked.
You did not wait for me to answer, and the next thing I knew, you had lifted the screen and were gone. I rushed over to the window, and when I leaned outside, I couldn't see you. I imagined you slipping on the shingles, falling into the shrubbery, my being blamed for the accident, for standing by stupidly as you did such a brazen thing.
Are you okay? I called out.
The logical thing would have been to say your name, but I felt inhibited and did not. Eventually you came back around, seated yourself on the incline over the garage, gazing down at the lawn.
What's behind the house?
Woods, but you can't go there.
Who said?
Everyone, my parents and all the teachers in school.
Why not?
A boy got lost in them last year. He's still missing. His name was Kevin McGrath, and he'd been 2 grades behind me. For a week we'd heard nothing but helicopters, dogs barking,
searching for some sign of him. You did not react to this information. Instead, you asked, "Why do people have yellow ribbons tied to their mailboxes?" "They're for the hostages in Iran." "I bet most Americans had never even heard of Iran before this," you said, causing me to feel responsible both for my neighbor's patriotism and for their ignorance. "What's that thing to the right?" "A swing set." The word must have amused you. You faced me and smiled, though not kindly, as if I'd invented the term. "I missed the cold," you said. "This cold." The remark reminded me that none of this was new to you. "And the snow. When will it snow again?" "I don't know. There wasn't much snow for Christmas this year." You climbed back into the room, disappointed, I feared, by my lack of information. You glanced at yourself in my white framed mirror, your head nearly cut off at the top. "Where's the bathroom?" you asked, already halfway out the door. That night, lying on the cot in my parents' room, wide awake though it was well past midnight, I heard my mother and father talking in the dark. I worried that perhaps you would hear them too. The bed where you slept was just on the other side of the wall, and if I had been able to stick my hand through it, I could have touched you. My parents were at once critical of and intimidated by yours, perplexed by the ways in which they had changed. Bombay had made them more American than Cambridge had, my mother said, something she hadn't anticipated and didn't understand. There were remarks concerning your mother's short hair, her slacks, the Johnny Walker she and your father continued to drink after the meal was finished, taking it with them from the dining room to the living room. It was mainly my mother who talked, my father listening and murmuring now and then in tired consent. My parents, who had never set foot in a liquor store, wondered whether they should buy another bottle. At the rate your parents were going, that bottle would be drained by tomorrow, my mother said. She remarked that your mother had become stylish, a pejorative term in her vocabulary, implying a self-indulgence that she shunned. 12 people could have flown for the price of one first-class ticket, she said. My mother's birthdays came and went without acknowledgement by my father. I was the one who made a card and had him sign it with me on the first of every June. Suddenly my mother sat up, sniffing the air. I smell smoke, she said. My father asked if she had remembered to turn off the oven. My mother said she was certain she had, but she asked him to get up and check. It's a cigarette you smell, he said when he came back to the bed. Someone has been smoking in the bathroom. I didn't know Dr. Chaudhary smoked, my mother said. Should we have put out an ashtray? In the morning you all slept in, victims of jet lag, reminding us that despite your presence, your bags crowding the hallways, your toothbrushes cluttering the side of the sink, you belonged elsewhere. When I returned from school in the afternoon, you were still sleeping, and at dinner, breakfast for you, you all declined the curry we were eating, craving toast and tea. It was like that for the first few days. You were awake when we slept, sleeping when we were awake. We were leading antipodal lives under the same roof. As a result, apart from the fact that I wasn't sleeping in my own room, there was little change. I drank my orange juice and ate my bowl of cereal and went off to the bus stop as usual. I spoke to no one of your arrival. I almost never revealed details of my home life to my American friends. As a child, I had always dreaded my birthdays, when a dozen girls would appear in the house, glimpsing the way we lived. I don't know how I would have referred to you. A family friend, I suppose? Then one day I came home from school and found your parents awake, their ankles crossed on top of the coffee table, filling up the sofa where I normally sat to watch The Brady Bunch and Gilligan's Island. They were chatting with my mother, who was in the recliner with a bowl in her lap, peeling potatoes. Your mother was dressed in a nylon sari of my mother's, purple with red dots in various sizes. Distressing news of your mother's missing suitcase had come. It had been located in Rome, but it had been placed on a flight to Johannesburg. I remember thinking that the sari looked better on your mother than on mine. The intense purple shade was more flattering against her skin. I was told that you were outside in the yard. I did not go out to look for you. Instead, I practiced the piano. It was nearly dark by the time you came in, accepting the tea that I was still too young to drink. Your parents drank tea as well, but by 6 o'clock, the bottle of Johnny Walker was on the coffee table, as it would be every night that you stayed with us. You had gone out only in a pullover, your father's costly camera slung around your neck. Your face showed the effects of the cold, your eyes blazing, the borders of your ears crimson, your skin glowing from within. There's a stream back there, you said, in those woods. My mother became nervous then, warning you not to go there, as she had so often warned me, as I had warned you the night you came, but your parents did not share her concern.
What did you photograph? They asked instead.
Nothing, you replied, and I took it personally that nothing had inspired you. The suburbs were new to you and to your parents. Whatever memories you possessed of America were of Cambridge, a place that I could only dimly recall. You took your tea and disappeared to my room as if it were yours, emerging only when summoned for dinner. You ate quickly, not speaking, then returned upstairs. It was your parents who paid me court, who asked me questions and complimented me on my manners, on my piano playing, on all the things I did to help my mother around the house.
Look, Koshik, how Hema makes her lunch, your mother would say as I prepared a ham or turkey sandwich after dinner and put it in a paper bag to take to school the next day.
I was still very much a child, while you, just 3 years older, had already eluded your parents' grasp. You did not argue with them, and yet you did not seem to talk to them very much either. While you were outside, I'd heard them tell my mother how unhappy you were to be back.
He was furious that we left, and now he's furious that we're here again, your father said. Even in Bombay, we managed to raise a typical American teenager.
I did my homework at the dining table, unable to use the desk in my room. I worked on my ancient Rome report, something that had interested me until your arrival. Now it seemed silly, given that you'd been there. I longed to work on it in privacy, but your father talked to me at length about the structural aspects of the Colosseum. His civil engineer's explanations went over my head, were irrelevant to my needs, but to be polite, I listened. I worried that he would want to see whether I had incorporated the things he said, but he never bothered me about that. He hunted through his bags and showed me postcards he had purchased, and though it had nothing to do with my report, he gave me a 2 lira coin. When the worst of your jet lag had subsided, we went to the mall in my parents' station wagon. Your mother needed bras, one item she could not borrow from my voluptuous mother. At the mall, our fathers sat together in a sunken area of benches and potted plants, waiting, and you were given some money and allowed to wander off while I accompanied our mothers to the lingerie department in Jordan Marsh. Your mother led us there, with a credit card your father had handed to her before they parted. Normally, we went to Sears. On her way to the bras, she bought black leather gloves and a pair of boots that zipped to the knee, never looking at the price before taking something off the shelf. In the lingerie department, it was me the saleswoman approached. "We have lovely training models just in," she said to your mother, believing that I was her daughter.
"Oh no, she's far too young," my mother said.
"But look how sweet," your mother said, fingering the style the saleswoman presented on a hanger, lacy white, with a rosebud at its center. I had yet to get my period, and unlike many of the girls at school, still wore flower-printed undershirts. I was ushered into the fitting room, your mother watching approvingly as I took off my coat and sweater and tried on the bra. She adjusted the straps and attached the hook at the back. She tried things on as well, topless beside me without shame, though it embarrassed me to see her large, plum-colored nipples, the surprising droop of her breasts, the dark patches of underarm hair that gave off a faintly acrid but not altogether unpleasant smell.
"Perfect," your mother said, running her finger below the elastic along my skin, adding, "I hope you know you're going to be very beautiful one day."
Despite my mother's protests, your mother bought me my first 3 bras, insisting that they were a gift. On the way out, at the makeup counter, she bought a lipstick, a bottle of perfume, and an assortment of expensive creams that promised to firm her throat and brighten her eyes. She was uninterested in the Avon products my mother used. The reward for her purchases at the makeup counter was a large red tote bag. This she gave to me, thinking that it would be useful for my books, and the next day I took it to school. After a week, your father began his new job, at an engineering firm 40 miles away. At first, my father got up early and dropped him off before returning to Northeastern to teach his economics classes. Then your father bought an Audi with a stick shift. You stayed home with our mothers. Your parents wanted to wait until they'd bought their home to see which school you'd go to. I was stunned and envious. 1/2 year without school? To my added chagrin, you were not expected to do anything around the house, never to return your plate or glass to the sink, never to make my bed, which I would see from time to time through the partly open door to my room in a state of total disarray, the blanket on the floor, your clothes heaped on my white desk. You ate enormous amounts of fruit, whole bunches of grapes, apples to their cores,
a practice that fascinated me. I did not eat fresh fruit then. The textures and intensity of flavors made me gag. You complained about the taste or lack of taste, but nevertheless decimated whatever my parents brought home from Star Market. I would find you when I came home in the afternoons, always at the same end of the sofa, the toes of your thin bare feet hooked around the edge of the coffee table, reading books by Isaac Asimov that you'd picked off my father's shelves in the basement. I hated Doctor Who, the one show you liked on television. I did not know what to make of you. Because you'd lived in India, I associated you more with my parents than with me. And yet you were unlike my cousins in Calcutta, who seemed so innocent and obedient when I visited them, asking questions about my life in America as if it were the moon, astonished by every detail. You were not curious about me in the least. One day a friend invited me to see The Empire Strikes Back on a Saturday afternoon. My mother said that I could go, but only if you were invited as well. I protested, telling her that my friend did not know you. Despite my crush, I didn't want to have to explain to my friend who you were and why you were living in our house.
You know him, my mother said.
But he doesn't even like me, I complained.
Of course he likes you, my mother said, blind to the full implication of what I'd said.
He's adjusting, Hema. It's something you've never had to go through.
The conversation ended there. As it turned out, you were uninterested in the movie, not having seen Star Wars in the first place. One day I found you sitting at my piano, randomly striking the keys with your index finger. You stood up when you saw me and retreated to the couch.
Do you hate it here? I asked.
I liked living in India, you said.
I did not betray my opinion that I found trips to India dull, that I didn't like the geckos that clung to the walls in the evenings, poking in and out of the fluorescent light fixtures, or the giant cockroaches that sometimes watched me as I bathed. I didn't like the comments my relatives made freely in my presence, that I had not inherited my mother's graceful hands, that my skin had darkened since I was a child.
Bombay is nothing like Calcutta, you added, as if reading my mind.
Is it close to the Taj Mahal?
No.
You looked at me carefully, as if fully registering my presence for the first time.
Haven't you ever looked at a map?
On our trip to the mall, you'd bought a record, something by the Rolling Stones. The jacket was white with what seemed to be a cake on it. You had no interest in the few records I owned. ABBA, Sean Cassidy, a disco compilation I'd ordered from a TV commercial with my allowance money. Nor were you willing to play your album on the plastic record player in my room. You opened up the cabinet where my father kept his turntable and receiver. My father was extremely particular about his stereo components. They were off-limits to me and even to my mother. The stereo had been the single extravagant purchase of his life. He cleaned everything himself, wiping the parts with a special cloth on Saturday mornings before listening to his collections of Indian vocalists.
You can't touch that, I said.
You turned around. The lid of the player was already lifted, the record revolving. You held the arm of the needle, resting its weight on your finger.
I know how to play a record, you said,
no longer making an effort to conceal your irritation. And then you let the needle drop. How bored you must have been in my room full of a girl's things. It must have driven you crazy being stuck with our mothers all day long as they cooked and watched soap operas. Really, it was my mother who did the cooking now. Though your mother kept her company, occasionally peeling or slicing something, she was no longer interested in cooking as she had been in the Cambridge days. She'd been spoiled by Zareen, the fabulous Parsi cook you had in Bombay, she said. From time to time, she would promise to make us an English trifle, the one thing she said she always insisted on making herself, but this didn't materialize. She continued to borrow saris from my mother and went to the mall to buy herself more sweaters and trousers. Her missing suitcase never arrived, and she accepted this fact calmly, saying it gave her an excuse to buy new things. But your father battled on her behalf, making a series of irate phone calls to the airline before finally letting the matter go. You were in the house as little as possible, walking in the cold weather through the woods and along streets where you were the only pedestrian. I spotted you once while I was on the school bus coming home, shocked at how far you'd gone.
You're going to get sick, Kaushik, always wandering around like that, my mother said.
She continued to speak to you in Bengali, despite your consistently English replies. It was your mother who came down with a cold, using this as an excuse to stay in bed for days. She refused the food my mother made for the rest of us, requesting only canned chicken broth. You walked to the mini-mart a mile from our house, bringing back the broth and issues of Vogue and Harper's Bazaar.
Go ask Parul Mashi if she wants tea, my mother said one afternoon,
and I headed upstairs to the guest room.
On my way, I needed to use the bathroom. There was your mother, wrapped up in a robe, perched morosely on the edge of the bathtub, legs crossed, smoking a cigarette.
"Oh, Hema!" she cried out, nearly falling into the tub, so startled that she crushed the cigarette against the porcelain and not into the tiny stainless steel ashtray she held cupped in her palm, and which she must have brought with her from Bombay.
"I'm sorry," I said, turning to leave.
"No, no, please, I was just going," she said.
I watched as she flushed away the cigarette, rinsed her mouth at the sink, and applied fresh lipstick, blotting it with a Kleenex, which then fluttered into the garbage pail. Apart from her bindi, my mother did not wear makeup, and I observed your mother's ritual with care, all the more impressed that she would go to such lengths when she was unwell and spending most of her day in bed. She looked into the mirror intently, without evasion. The brief application of lipstick seemed to restore the composure that my sudden appearance had caused her to lose. She caught me looking at her reflection and smiled.
"One cigarette a day can't kill me, can it?" she said brightly.
She opened the window, pulled some perfume out of her cosmetics bag, and sprayed the air.
"Our little secret, Hema," she said, less a question than a command, and left, shutting the door behind her.
In the evenings, we sometimes went house hunting with you. We took the station wagon. The beautiful car your father had bought could not comfortably accommodate us all. My father drove, hesitantly, to unknown neighborhoods, where the lawns were a little bigger than ours, the houses spaced a little farther apart. Your parents searched first in Lexington and Concord, where the schools were best. Some of the homes we saw were empty, others full of the current occupants and their possessions. None, according to the conversations I overheard at night as I tried to fall asleep, were the sort my parents could afford. They stepped to the side as your parents discussed asking prices with the real estate agents. But it wasn't money that stood in the way. The houses themselves were the problem. The lights scant, the ceilings low, the rooms awkward, your parents always concluded, as we drove back to our house. Unlike my parents, yours had opinions about design, preferring something contemporary, excited when we happened to pass a white box-like structure obscured by a thicket of tall trees. They sought an in-ground pool or space to build one. Your mother missed swimming at her club in Bombay.
"Water views, that's what we should look for," your mother said, while reading the classified section of the Globe one afternoon, and this limited the search even further.
We drove out to Swampscott and Duxbury to see properties overlooking the ocean, and to houses in the woods with views of private lakes. Your parents made an offer on a house in Beverly, but after a second visit they withdrew the bid, your mother saying that the layout was ungenerous. My parents felt slighted by your parents' extravagant visions, ashamed of the modest home we owned.
"How uncomfortable you must be here," they said.
But your parents never complained, as mine did, nightly, before falling asleep.
"I didn't expect it to take this long," my mother said, noting that almost a month had gone by.
"While you were with us, there was no room for anyone else.
The Das Guptas wanted a visit next weekend, and I had to say no," my mother said.
Again and again I heard how much your parents had changed, how we had unwittingly opened our house to strangers. There were complaints about how your mother did not help clean up after dinner, how she went to bed whenever it suited her, and slept close to lunchtime. My mother said that your father was too indulgent, too solicitous of your mother, always asking if she needed a fresh drink, bringing down a cardigan if she was cold.
"She's the reason they're still here," my mother said. "She won't settle for anything less than a palace." "It's no easy task," my father said diplomatically. "Starting a new job, a new way of life all over again. My guess is she didn't want to leave, and he's trying to make up for that. You would never put up with that sort of behavior in me."
"Let it go," my father said, turning away from her and tucking the covers under his chin.
"It's not forever. They'll leave soon enough, and then all our lives will go back to normal."
Somewhere in that cramped house, a line was drawn between our two families. On one side was the life we'd always led, my parents taking me to Star Market every Thursday night, treating me to McDonald's afterward. Every Sunday I studied my weekly spelling test, my father quizzing me after 60 minutes was over. Your family began to do things independently as well. Sometimes your father would come home from work early and take your mother out, either to look at properties or to shop at the mall, where slowly and methodically she began to buy all the things she would need to set up her own household. Sheets, blankets, plates, and glasses,
small appliances. They would come home with bags and bags, amassing them in our basement, sometimes showing my mother the things they'd bought, sometimes not bothering. On Fridays, your parents often took us out to dinner, to one of the overpriced, mediocre restaurants in town. They enjoyed the change of pace, having mysteriously acquired a taste for things like steak and baked potatoes, while my parents had not. The outings were intended to give my mother a break from cooking, but she complained about these, too. I was the only one who didn't mind your staying with us. In my quiet, complicated way, I continued to like you, was happy simply to observe you day after day. And I liked your parents, your mother especially. The attention I got from her almost made up for what I didn't get from you. One day your father developed the photographs from your stay in Rome. I enjoyed seeing the prints, holding them carefully by the edges. The pictures were almost all of you and your mother, posing in piazzas or sitting on the edge of fountains. There were two shots of Trajan's column, nearly identical.
"Take one for your report," your father said, handing me one. "That should impress your teacher."
But I wasn't there.
"No matter, say your uncle went to Rome and took a snap for you."
You were in the picture, standing to one side. You were looking down, your face obscured by a visor. You could have been anyone, one of the many passing tourists in the frame, but it bothered me that you were there, your presence threatening to expose the secret attraction I felt and still hoped would be acknowledged somehow. You had successfully wiped away all the other crushes I harbored at school, so that I thought only of being at home and of where in the course of the afternoon and evening our paths might intersect, whether or not you would bother to glance at me at the dinner table. Long hours were devoted, lying on the cot in my parents' room, to imagining you kissing me. I was too young, too inexperienced, to contemplate anything beyond that. I accepted the picture and pasted it into my report, but not before cutting the part with you away. That bit I kept, hidden among the blank pages of my diary, locked up for years. Your wish for snow had not been granted since you had arrived. There were brief flurries now and again, but nothing stuck to the ground. Then one day, snow began to fall, barely visible at first, gathering force as the afternoon passed, an inch or so coating the streets by the time I rode the bus home from school. It was not a dangerous storm, but significant enough to break up the monotony of winter. My mother, in a cheerful mood that evening, decided to cook a big pot of khichdi, which she typically made when it rained, and for a change your mother insisted on helping, standing in the kitchen deep-frying pieces of potato and cauliflower, melting sticks of butter in a saucepan for ghee. She also decided that she wanted, finally, to make the long-promised trifle, and when my mother told her that there weren't enough eggs, your father went to get them, along with the other ingredients she needed. "It won't be ready until midnight," she said as she beat together hot milk and eggs over the stove, allowing me to take over for her when she tired of the task. "It needs at least 4 hours to set." "Then we can have it for breakfast," you said, breaking off a piece of the pound cake she'd sliced, stuffing it into your mouth. You seldom set foot in the kitchen, but that evening you hovered there, excited by the promise of trifle, which I gathered you loved and which I had never tasted. After dinner, we crowded into the living room, watching the news as the snow continued to fall, excited to learn that my school would be closed and my father's classes canceled the next day.
"You take the day off too," your mother said to your father,
and to everyone's surprise, he agreed.
"It reminds me of the winter we left Cambridge," your father said.
He and your mother were sipping their Johnny Walker, and that night, though my mother still refused, my father agreed to join them for a small taste.
"That party you had for us," your father continued, turning to my parents, "remember?"
7 years ago," my mother said.
"'Twas another life back then."
They spoke of how young you and I had been, how much younger they had all been.
"Such a lovely evening," your mother recalled, her voice betraying a sadness that all of them seemed to share. "How different things were."
In the morning, icicles hung from our windows, and a foot of snow blanketed the ground. The trifle, which we had been too tired to wait for the night before, emerged for breakfast along with toast and tea. It was not what I'd expected, the hot mixture I'd helped beat on the stove now cold and slippery, but you devoured bowl after bowl. Your mother finally put it away, fearing that you would get a stomachache. After breakfast, our fathers took turns with a shovel, clearing the driveway. When the wind had settled, I was allowed to go outside.
Usually I made snowmen alone, scrawny and lopsided, my parents complaining when I asked for a carrot that it was a waste of food. But this time you joined me, touching the snow with your bare hands, studying it, looking happy for the first time since you arrived. You packed a bit of it into a ball and tossed it in my direction. I ducked out of the way and then threw one at you, hitting you in the leg, aware of the camera hanging around your neck. "I surrender," you said, raising your arms. "This is beautiful," you added, looking around at our lawn, which the snow had transformed. I felt flattered, though I had nothing to do with the weather. You began walking toward the woods, and I hesitated. "There was something you wanted to show me there," you said. Covered in snow on that bright blue sky day, the bare branches of the trees concealing so little, it seemed safe. I did not think of the boy, lost there and never found. From time to time you stopped, focusing your camera on something, never asking me to pose. We walked a long way until I no longer heard the sounds of snow being shoveled, no longer saw our house. I didn't realize at first what you were doing, getting on your knees and pushing away at the snow. Underneath was a rock of some sort. And then I saw that it was a tombstone. You uncovered a row of them, flat on the ground. I began to help you, unburying the buried, using my mittened hands at first, then my whole arm. They belonged to people named Simons, a family of six. "They're all here together," you said. "Mother, father, four children." I never knew this was here. I doubt anyone does. It was buried under leaves when I first found it. The last one, Emma, died in 1923. I nodded, disturbed by the similarity of the name to mine, wondering if this had occurred to you. "It makes me wish we weren't Hindu, so that my mother could be buried somewhere. But she's made us promise we'll scatter her ashes into the Atlantic." I looked at you, confused, and so you continued, explaining that there was cancer in her breast, spreading through the rest of her body. That was why you had left India. It was not so much for treatment as it was to be left alone. In India, people knew she was dying, and had you remained there, inevitably friends and family would have gathered at her side in your beautiful seaside apartment, trying to shield her from something she could not escape. Your mother, not wanting to be suffocated by the attention, not wanting her parents to witness her decline, had asked your father to bring you all back to America. "She's been seeing a new doctor at Mass General. That's where my father often takes her when they say they're going to see houses. She's going to have surgery in the spring, but it's only to buy her a little more time. She doesn't want anyone here to know, not until the end." The information fell between us, as shocking as if you'd struck me in the face, and I began to cry. At first, the tears fell silently, sliding over my nearly frozen face, but then I started sobbing, becoming ugly in front of you, my nose running in the cold, my eyes turning red. I stood there, my hands wedged under my cheekbones to catch the tears, mortified that you were witnessing such a pathetic display. Though you had never taken a picture of me in your life, I was afraid you would lift the camera and capture me that way. Of course, you did nothing. You said nothing. You had said enough. You remained where you were, looking down at the tombstone of Emma Simons, and eventually when I calmed down, you began to walk back to our yard. I followed you along the path you had discovered, and then we parted, neither of us a comfort to the other. You shoveling the driveway, I going inside for a hot shower, my red puffy face assumed by our mothers to be a consequence of the cold. Perhaps you believed that I was crying for you or for your mother, but I was not. I was too young that day to feel sorrow or sympathy. I felt only the enormous fear of having a dying woman in our home. I remember standing beside your mother, both of us topless, in the fitting room where I tried on my first bra, disturbed that I had been in such close proximity to her disease. I was furious that you had told me, and that you had not told me, feeling at once burdened and betrayed, hating you all over again. 2 weeks later, you were gone. Your parents bought a house on the North Shore, which had been designed by a well-known Massachusetts architect. It had a perfectly flat roof and whole walls of glass. The upstairs rooms were arranged off an interior balcony, the ceiling in the living room soaring to 20 feet. There were no water views, but there was a pool for your mother to swim in, just as she had wanted. Your first night there, my mother brought food over so that your mother would not have to cook, not realizing what a favor this was. We admired the house and the property, the echoing, empty rooms that would soon be filled with sickness and grief. There was a bedroom with a skylight. Underneath it, your mother told us, she planned to position her bed. It was all to give her 2 years of pleasure. When my parents finally learned the news and went to the hospital where your mother was dying, I revealed nothing about what you had told me. In that sense, I remained loyal. Our parents were only acquaintances by then, having gone their separate ways after the weeks of forced intimacy. Your mother had promised to have us over in the summer to swim in the pool, but as her health declined, more quickly than the doctors had predicted, your parents shut down, still silent about her illness, seldom entertaining. For a time, my mother and father continued to complain, feeling snubbed.
"After all we did for them," they said before drifting off to sleep.
But I was back in my own room by then, on the other side of the wall, in the bed where you had slept, no longer hearing them.
Year's end. I did not attend my father's wedding. I did not even know there had been a wedding until my father called early one Sunday during my final year at Swarthmore. I was roused from sleep by a fist pounding on my door, followed by the voice of one of my hallmates saying my last name. I knew before answering that it was my father. There was no one else who would have called me before 9. My father had always been an early riser, believing that the hours between 5 and 7 were the most profitable part of the day. He would use that time to read the newspaper and then go for a walk along Marine Drive when we lived in Bombay and on the quiet roads of our town on the North Shore. And as much as he used to encourage my mother and me to join him, I knew he preferred being alone. Things were different now, of course. Those solitary hours he'd once savored had become a prison for him, a commonplace. I knew that he no longer bothered to go for walks, and that since my mother's death, he hardly slept at all. I had not spoken to my father in several weeks. He had been in Calcutta visiting my grandparents, all 4 of whom were still alive, and when I picked up the phone left for me hanging upside down by its cord, I expected him to say only that he had returned safely to Massachusetts, not that I now had a stepmother and 2 stepsisters. "I must tell you something that will upset you," he began. And I wondered if perhaps one of my grandparents had fallen ill, if my mother's parents in particular could no longer endure the loss of their only daughter at the age of 42. It had been the hardest thing in those first months after she was gone, having to go to Calcutta with my father and enter the home where my mother had been a girl, having to see the man and woman who had raised her, who had known her and loved her long before my father and I did. My grandparents had already lived in a state of mild mourning since 1962, when my parents were married. Occasionally, my mother would return to them, first from Boston, then Bombay, like Persephone in the myth, temporarily filling up and brightening the rooms, scattering her creams and powders on the dressing table, sipping tea from cups she'd known since she was a girl, sleeping in the room where she'd been small. After we called my grandparents from Massachusetts to tell them my mother was dead, they had held on to the hope that it was only a matter of time and that she would board a plane and walk through the door once again. Even after my father and I entered the house, my grandmother asked if my mother was still in the taxi that had already driven away, this in spite of the fact that a photograph of my mother, larger than life and draped with a tuberose garland, hung on their living room wall. "She's not with us, Didun," I said. And it was only then that both my grandparents broke down, grieving freshly for my mother, as neither my father nor I had done. Being with her through her illness day after day had denied us that privilege. "But my grandparents were fine," my father reported now. "They missed me and sent their love," he said. And then he told me about Chitra. She had lost her spouse 2 years ago, not to cancer, but encephalitis. Chitra was a school teacher, and at 35, nearly 20 years younger than my father. Her daughters were 7 and 10. He offered these details as if responding diligently to questions I was not asking. "I don't ask you to care for her, even to like her," my father said. "You are a grown man. You have no need for her in your life as I do. I only ask, eventually, that you understand my decision." It was clear to me that he had prepared himself for my outrage. Harsh words, accusations, the slamming down of the phone. But no turbulent emotion passed through me as he spoke. Only a diluted version of the nauseating sensation that had taken hold the day in Bombay that I learned my mother was dying. A sensation that had dropped anchor in me and never fully left. "Is she there with you?" I asked. "Would you like me to say something?" I said this more as a challenge than out of politeness, not entirely believing him. Since my mother's death, I frequently doubted things my father said in the course of our telephone conversations. That he had eaten dinner on any given night, for example, at the Italian restaurant he usually took me to when I went home, and not simply polished off another can of almonds and a few Johnny Walkers in front of the television. "They arrive in 2 weeks. You will see them when you come home for Christmas," my father said, adding, "Her English is not so good. Worse than my Bengali? Possibly. She will pick it up, of course." I didn't say what came to my lips, that my mother had learned English as a girl, that she had had no need to pick it up in America. "The girls are better at it," my father continued. "They've gone to English medium schools. I've enrolled them in their grades to start in January." He had known Chitra just a few weeks, had met her only twice before their marriage. It was a registry wedding, followed by a small dinner at a hotel. "The whole thing was arranged by relatives," he explained, in a way that suggested that he was not to blame. This remark upset me more than anything my father had said so far. My father was not a malleable man, and I knew that no one would have dared to find him a new wife unless he had requested it. "I was tired, Kaushik," he said. "Tired of coming home to an empty house every night." I didn't know which was worse, the idea of my father's remarrying for love or his actively seeking out a stranger for companionship. My parents had had an arranged marriage, but there was a touch of romance about it, too. My father seeing my mother for the first time at a wedding and being so attracted that he had asked the following week for her hand. They had always been affectionate with one another, but it wasn't until her illness that he seemed fully, recklessly to fall in love with her, so that I was a witness to a courtship that ought to have faded before I was born. He doted on her then, arriving home at our Bombay flat with flowers, lingering in bed with her in the mornings, going in late to work, wanting to be alone with her to the point where I, a teenager, felt in the way. "I thought," he continued, "since your bedroom is a good size, of putting the girls together there. Would you mind terribly staying in the guest room when you visit Kaushik? Most of your things are with you now anyway. It's just a matter of where to sleep. Please tell me if you mind." He seemed more concerned about my reaction to a new room than the fact that I had just acquired a new family. "It's fine. You are being honest?" I said I don't mind. I returned to my dorm room. There was a girl in my bed that morning. She had remained asleep as I pulled on my clothes and stumbled barefoot into the hallway to answer the phone. Now she was lying on her stomach, a pen in her hand, finishing a crossword I'd abandoned. Her name was Jessica, and I'd met her in my Spanish class. "Who is that?" she asked, turning to look at me. Strong sunlight angled in from the window behind her, darkening her to the point that her features were obscured. "My father," I said, squeezing back into the bed beside her. For a while, she continued pondering the puzzle as I lay curled at her side, the unfamiliar smell of her still thrilling. She knew nothing about my family, about my father's recent visit to Calcutta, or about my mother's death the summer before I started college. In the course of our few weekends together, I had told Jessica none of those things. That morning, after crying briefly against her body, I did. After my exams, I drove to Massachusetts, dropping off Jessica on the way at her parents' farmhouse in Connecticut. When I decided to attend Swarthmore, my father gave me the Audi he'd bought after we'd moved back from Bombay. He said that it would make it easier for me to come home from Pennsylvania during weekends and holidays, but I knew it was really an excuse to get rid of yet another thing my mother had touched, known, or otherwise occupied. The day we came back from the hospital for the last time, he took every single photograph of her, in frames and in albums, and put them in a shoebox. "Choose a few. I know pictures are important to you," he told me. And then he sealed the box with tape and put it in a closet somewhere. He had wasted no time giving away her clothes, her handbags, her boxes of cosmetics and colognes. That is probably the last time I remember you from that period. You and your mother coming to the house one day and spending an afternoon going through my mother's drawers as many others already had, fingering her things, lifting her sweaters and shawls to their chests to see if they would flatter them, testing to see if Chanel No. 5 would react as favorably with their skin. The items you and your mother and the other Bengali woman had no need for were sent to charities in India, as there was nowhere in New England to donate all those saris with their matching blouses and petticoats. This was according to my mother's instructions. "I don't want all that beautiful material turned into curtains," she told us from her hospital bed. Her ashes were tossed from a boat off the Gloucester coast that a co-worker of my father's, Jim Skillings, had arranged for, but her gold went back to Calcutta, distributed to poor women who had worked for my extended family as ayahs or cooks or maids. It didn't matter to me that her things were gone. After Bombay, she had little occasion to wear jewels and saris, saying no to most of the parties she and my father were invited to. Coming home from school toward the end, I would find her sitting wrapped in a blanket, looking out at the pool she no longer had strength to swim in. Sometimes I would take her outside for fresh air, walking carefully through the birches and pines behind the house and sitting with her on a low stone wall. Occasionally, feeling ambitious, she would ask me to drive her to the sea. "Be sure to keep my ruby choker and the pearl and emerald set for the person you will marry," she said during one of these walks. "I'm not planning on getting married anytime soon," I told her. And she said that she wished she could say the same for dying. Ultimately, I disobeyed her. After she was gone, I was unable to open up and examine the contents of all those flat red boxes she'd kept hidden in a suitcase on her closet shelf. Never mind set something aside for the sake of my future happiness. Late in the afternoon, I climbed the road that led to our driveway. Our house was the only source of light for miles amid isolated patches of hardened snow. It was not an easy, typically inviting place. Stone steps had been built into the uneven ground, flanked by overgrown rhododendrons leading to the entrance. I saw from the other car in the driveway that my father was home, and he stood behind the storm door, waiting for me to come in with my things. "We were expecting you earlier," he said. "You said you would be here by lunchtime." I knew then that it was true, that there was another person inside the house. A person who made it possible for my father without hesitating to say "we" instead of "I." I said nothing about my detour to Jessica's home and the 2 hours I'd spent there. Instead, I said the traffic had been bad. I wondered if my father had left work early for my sake, or if perhaps he had not gone into the office that day. I could not tell from his appearance. He had given up wearing suits and was dressed as he might be for the weekend, in dark blue pants and a cream-colored sweater. There was more gray in his hair than I remembered, and though he was still vigorously handsome, old age was creeping into his face, the skin sagging at the sides of his nose, his palish green eyes, a trait that made my mother insist that there was Irish blood on his side of the family, less curious than they had once been. I tried to imagine him, just weeks before, in a silk kurta, a groom's toper on his head. I wondered who had taken photographs of the wedding, whether my father would show them to me. I was unused, stepping into the house, to the heavy smell of cooking that was in the air. Otherwise, things appeared unchanged. The black and white photographs I'd taken of the surrounding woods, which my mother had insisted on framing, still lining one wall of the entryway. The house had always maintained an impersonal quality, full of built-in cupboards concealing the traces of our everyday lives. Now that I no longer lived there, I was astonished by how enormous it was, the soaring double-height ceiling of the living room, and the great wall of glass looking out onto the trees, more befitting of an institution than a private home. There was a window seat running along the length of the glass wall, enough space for 20 people to sit side by side, as they had during my mother's funeral. As soon as I removed my coat, my father hung it in a cupboard, then led me to the dining table. My mother had insisted on furnishing the house with pieces true to its modernist architecture. A black leather sectional configured in a U, a chrome floor lamp arcing overhead, a glass-topped kidney-shaped cocktail table, and a dining table made of white fiberglass surrounded by matching chairs. She had never allowed a cloth to cover the table, but one was there now, something with an Indian print that could just as easily have been a bedspread and didn't fully reach either end. In the center, instead of the generous cluster of fresh fruit or flowers my mother would have arranged, there was a stainless steel plate holding an ordinary salt shaker and two jars of pickles, hot mango and sweet lime, their lids missing, their labels stained, spoons stuck into their oils. A single place had been set for me at one end, with translucent luchis piled on a plate and several smaller bowls containing dal and vegetables arrayed in a semicircle. "Sit down," my father said. "You must be hungry." He was nervous, as I was. There was no drink in his hand, no bottle of Johnny Walker set out, as it usually was by this time on the cocktail table. I remained standing, uninterested in the food, staring down at the table. I was no longer accustomed to Indian food. At school, I ate in the cafeteria, and during my time at home, after my mother's death, my father and I either went out or picked up pizzas, so that the impressive gas stove that my mother was so excited about when we moved in, with the inset grill, where she said she would make kebabs, was used only to boil water for tea. I looked above the table at one corner of the ceiling and saw that it was discolored by a leak. "When did that happen?" I asked.
"A while back."
"Aren't you going to fix it?" My father, sensitive to how buildings were put together, had always been particular about that sort of thing.
"It's a big project," he said. "There's a reason roofs should be sloped in this part of the world."
I heard no voices or footsteps, no sound of cooking or water running in the kitchen. It was as if Chitra and her daughters were discreetly hidden in one of the many cupboards of the house, swallowed up as so many other things were. "Where are they?" I asked finally. She appeared then, walking through the swinging doors that led to the kitchen. She was closer to my age than my father's. I had known this beforehand, but seeing her was a shock. Her hair was long and dark, and she had a broad nose on an otherwise pleasant face, though it was too round for me to find beautiful. She was taller than I expected her to be, a little taller than my mother. She wore vermilion in her hair, a traditional practice my mother had shunned, the powdery red stain, the strongest element of her appearance.
"I would like for you to call me Mamoni," she said in Bengali.
Her voice was of a lower pitch than my mother's, with a faint huskiness that was oddly calming.
"Do you have any objection to that?"
She asked this kindly, smiling, wary of my reaction, and I shook my head, not smiling back.
"Please,"
she said, this time in English, motioning to the chair. I turned to my father and asked, "Aren't we all eating?"
"We already have," Chitra said, switching back to Bengali. "You have driven from so far. More is coming."
She turned abruptly to the kitchen, and I sat down. My mouth watered, in spite of my reluctance to eat, and I was suddenly grateful for the vast amount of food in front of me. The last thing I'd eaten was a slice of fruitcake baked by Jessica's mother, whom I'd met in the course of dropping Jessica off. It was a delicious cake, and Jessica's mother cut off some extra pieces for me, wrapping them in foil for the road, but I had forgotten them on the coffee table in their living room, distracted after Jessica kissed me on the four-poster bed of her childhood room.
"Start, Kaushik," my father said, sitting down in a chair beside me. "It's getting cold."
The arrangement of the bowls, small glass bowls in which we normally had ice cream, felt too formal to me. This was the old-fashioned, ceremonious way I remembered my grandfather's eating in Calcutta, being treated each day like kings after their morning baths. I wondered what was the best way to go about it, whether to take a spoonful of each dish as I went, or to dump everything onto the plate at once. In the meantime, I ate the luchis, still warm and impressively puffed on their own. I was reminded of Sunday mornings in Bombay, eating luchis prepared by our Parsi cook Zareen. I could hear my mother complaining cheerfully in the kitchen, telling Zareen to try another batch, that she was frying them before the oil was hot enough. When Chitra returned, she was followed by her daughters, two girls who at first glance, apart from a few inches in height, were indistinguishable. They were overdressed in our comfortably heated house in thick sweaters and socks, incongruous Indian things that would soon be rejected, I knew, in favor of clothes from the mall. The sweaters were made of the same sickeningly bright shade of pink wool. The girls did not resemble Chitra very strongly. They were darker and sweeter looking, with heart-shaped faces and two black ponytails on either side of their heads adorned with red ribbons. "Would you like some of this?" I asked, pointing to the luchis still on my plate. And to my surprise, they stepped forward and both put out a hand, cupping their giggling mouths with the other. I saw that one of the girls, the shorter one, was missing a front tooth. "Let Dada eat in peace," Chitra said. She had treaded cautiously in terms of what I was to call her, but now referred to me without hesitation as the girl's older brother. "You can call me Kaushik," I said to the girls, and this made them put their hands back over their mouths and giggle more forcefully. "What about KD?" my father suggested. We all turned to him, puzzled, this man for whom we were now gathered together. "Short for Kaushik Dada," he explained. I wondered if this was something that had just popped into his head, or if he'd considered it carefully beforehand. He had always possessed an inventive streak when it came to words, writing Bengali poems on weekends and reading them aloud to my mother. From her comments, I gathered that the poems were witty. It had been one of our family secrets, the fact that my civil engineer father was also a poet. Though I never asked about it, I'd assumed he'd stopped writing after my mother's death, as he'd stopped doing so many things. "That's clever," Chitra said, speaking directly to my father for the first time since my arrival. She spoke approvingly, with the tone of someone who is used to acknowledging small achievements, and it was then that I remembered that she had been a school teacher in her former life. "Yes, KD is better." I found the nickname inane, but my father seemed proud of it, and it was preferable to Chitra's alternative. "And what do I call you?" I asked my stepsisters.
"I'm Rupa,"
said the taller one, her voice husky like her mother's.
"And I'm Pew,"
said the one missing the tooth.
"We are very glad to be in your room,"
Rupa added. She spoke stiffly, a bit distantly, as if reciting something she'd been forced to memorize.
"We are very much appreciating."
They spoke to me in English, their accents and their intonations sounding as severe as mine must have sounded to your fully American ear when we arrived as refugees in your family's home. I knew the accents would soon diminish and then disappear, as would their unstylish sweaters, their silly hairstyles.
"Rupa and Pew are eager to see the aquarium."